even that line between someone just being angry, emotionally upset, and just having narcissistic traits is the more narcissistic someone is, the less ability they have after the event to reflect and look at their fault and things.
Chetna, what's the difference between a narcissist, a sociopath, and a psychopath?
Okay, it depends on whether you're looking at it colloquially or whether you're looking at it clinically.
Well, let's do both.
Yeah. Colloquially is how everybody would talk about it, perhaps on social media, from experience, etc., in conversation.
I.e. they don't know what they're talking about,
and they'll probably use... and I don't mean that in an insulting way, it's just when topics
But they don't know the
up.
Definition.
Yes.
Because people use the word narcissism as a weapon, don't they? Hey, they're a narcissist, my ex is a narcissist.
Yes, or my ex was a sociopath, or yeah, my ex was like a psychopath. And there's that whole series on Netflix, that popular series, is it The One? Or You, or something like
you.
That. That's it, You. It's about a sociopath. Yeah. So what's the difference? So in lay people's terms, they probably don't know the definition, so we'll use them interchangeably. Okay, and lay people will probably use them to refer to somebody who's treated them badly, who's been selfish, who's perhaps behaved irrationally.
Or they perceive has.
Or they perceive has behaved
they might not have.
Irrationally.
Yeah.
They may not have, exactly,
yeah.
Exactly. It is thrown about very loosely.
Yeah.
If you look at it clinically, when we're talking about sociopaths, psychopaths, or narcissists, we're talking about the personality disorder, which is the severe end of the spectrum. It refers to maladaptive personality traits, which generally serve to protect the person's self-identity and esteem, which has been damaged whilst they were growing up. And when we say maladaptive, they've got unhealthy personality traits, which at the end of the day tend to hurt other people in the protection of themselves, because that's what they've learned. And sociopath, psychopath, they mean different things depending on which clinical criteria you use, British or American. And narcissistic personality disorder is pretty much the same, but there are particular diagnostic criteria for each one.
Hit me then.
Hit you?
Yeah.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so if you look at narcissistic personality disorder, for example, the whole idea around a narcissistic personality disorder and the development of that disorder is around self-importance, self-preservation, self-protection. So these people will often, the more severe it is, be very preoccupied with how they're perceived. Okay, and so everything's rooted in that. How am I perceived by the outside world? So much so that how you're perceived by the outside world is almost a replacement for how you see yourself, because your sense of self is so disordered. Your own sense of self is so disordered. So given that your sense of self is so rooted in other people's sense of or belief of who you are, you spend a lot of time, the narcissistic personality disorder, their whole life is built around making sure that that is, other people's perception of them is always preserved in whichever way possible. And usually that requires lying of some sort. That usually requires gaslighting others. So getting them to doubt themselves, relinquish their own judgment in favor of the narcissist's story that's been spun. And the thing is, whilst this keeps up appearances, and this may lead to a general level of functioning, and even having relationships at a job, etc., there's usually either a dysfunctional pattern in the relationships and at work, or the function that appears to be there's very, it's just at the surface, it's just skin deep. Inside, they often are feeling quite anxious, lonely, depressed, victimized, challenged. And in the end, that does tend to give way. So they either end up being isolated, so alone at home and very successful externally, or successful externally and at home having very difficult relationships. Yeah, I mean, that's your narcissistic personality disorder. And the more severe it is, the less they're able to maintain their success outside, because things just start crumbling around them. Whereas you're looking at sociopaths and psychopaths, or the sociopathic or psychopathic personality disorder, they often go hand in hand. So you'll see those same traits, a life built up around, you know, lies and perception and manipulation. But for the sociopath or psychopath, there's also then this added lack of, or there's a disregard for law, there's a disregard for morals, depending on how severe it is. There's a disregard for other people's feelings, empathy. There's a lack of empathy on both, but with a narcissist, the empathy is there to serve their self-preservation. So they will relate to you as long as it's in their best interest. With a sociopath, they find it very difficult to connect and understand other people's emotions. That's where their charm is very superficial. So with the sociopathic or psychopathic, very extreme personality disorders, you often find them engaging in crime or violence and highly dysfunctional patterns.
Can you define what dysfunctional is?
Yeah, dysfunctional is what it says, that you're...
But don't we have to, sorry to interrupt, don't we have to define what functional is mm-hmm. to define what dysfunctional
is? Yeah, so when it stops working for you, it's dysfunctional.
But surely a lot of these people don't think there's anything wrong with them.
They usually know. They usually know there's something not right because they're very unhappy and they often have anxiety and depression alongside it. They're often engaging in activities that they wouldn't choose to do. Right, think about it. If somebody with a narcissistic personality disorder wants to be held in high regard, be loved, be successful, be seen to be a good person, they would like to actually do good things. Right? They would like to have successful careers without having to manipulate others, without having to hurt other people. But when they see that gap, that they are engaging in actions that they wouldn't hold somebody else in high regard for, then that's dysfunctional.
Even the sociopaths have a self-awareness of that, do they?
Then they get frustrated. Yes, they have some awareness of it, but the self-protection mechanism, and this is where we say it's maladaptive. The self-protection mechanism is so strong that the maladaptive behavior...
What does maladaptive mean?
So we all have an ability to adapt to our environment, to our circumstances, to protect ourselves in the service of others for so many reasons, right? To find our purpose. Maladaptive is where those purposes are being served, but with patterns which are at the expense of others and at the expense of ourselves, ultimately.
Right.
So when you have a personality disorder, even if you know what the best thing to do in a situation is, because your self-preservation kicks in and you've either been exposed to or had to use those patterns in the past to protect yourself, that is where you go to by default. Which is why it means that, I guess the hope in that is that because it's been developed, it can be redeveloped and molded into something else.
So what are the insecurities? What's hurt inside these people that makes them want to hurt and control others for their own self-preservation?
Their sense of who they are. So they've been invalidated. They've often been neglected. They've often had their own judgment broken, and they've lost trust in themselves. Abuse generally can go two ways. Either abuse breeds more abuse, or with a lot of work, reflection, and help, abuse can actually, for some people, enable them to grow and be stronger and better people. That's not always the case. So it's not black and white. There can be elements of both. Mm. You may have to go through a period of one before reaching the other. But generally, somewhere in your development, in your early life, either in your upbringing, either through some other authority, could be at school, and you see it in boarding schools happen, or in a relationship, maybe one of your earlier relationships, your first relationship. Somebody's spent a lot of time in an environment, in a relationship where you've let go, you've let your guard down, you've let that person in, and they have basically disordered your sense of self through those various methods like invalidation, neglect, and psychological abuse, physical abuse, sexual abuse. And so, we all thrive, and are the basis, our foundation for life is who do I think I am, isn't it? Who do I think I am? Our purpose is born of who we think we are.
Mm.
Right? There's a lot of talk about find your purpose. But if I don't know where I'm standing, if I don't know who or what's standing right here, how do I know where I'm going to go to? So once that has been damaged, it becomes hard then to engage with other parts of life, like finding your purpose, like finding relationships, healthy relationships.
But why don't these people, general term, look inside rather than trying to control outside? What do they not know?
So all of us are products of, to a large part, our early life experiences. A lot of them have been absorbed unconsciously. Think about it. When we were younger, how much did we question our parents? We just did what we were told. And a lot of what we learned was just by observation. everything from how you express affection, how you deal with stress, what your views on politics, on physical health, mental, everything. We absorb so much. And if nobody's modeled for you or told you about or shown you how to be self-reflective, that's not going to be your default. For example, you look at our culture in this country towards alcohol. Okay, it is socially acceptable when you're feeling stressed to have a drink. It is even socially acceptable to get drunk. In fact, it can be celebrated to get drunk, isn't it? So if that's happening at home with your parents, that whenever my parents are upset or sad, they just hit the bottle, then as you grow up, there's not going to be that filter that comes from questioning. There's just going to be, okay, I'm feeling stressed out. And it will almost be automatic. I'll go down to the pub, or I'll go out for drinks, or I'll have a little bit extra. It's okay, that's just what you do when you're stressed. Compare that to a household where someone's not been exposed to that. Maybe it's a different way of coping with stress. They're gonna question it. Even if someone says, have a drink if you're feeling stressed, and go, well, they're going to have that space to stop and question. Does that make sense?
Is being a narcissist or performing narcissistic behaviors a form of abuse to someone?
Generally, if you are in relationships, to the degree that you act on the narcissistic personality triggers and impulses, to that degree, you're more likely to hurt another person, yes.
And what are the narcissistic triggers?
So narcissistic triggers are, for example, being criticized, anything that threatens your sense of who you are, i.e. the public perception of you, okay?
Yeah.
So, or a particular group's perception of you. Because remember, with narcissists, depending on how sophisticated their web of creating different groups who have different opinions of them. They may have one group of friends who think they have a particular career and see them in high regard and successful in that career. Their family may think they're particularly good at something else and have a particular persona at home, etc. Their parents might think something else. Cousins abroad might think something else. So in maintaining these groups, their narcissistic supply, their supply of keeping their sense of self preserved, is quite spread out. So if their trigger is one group has caught them out, has realized what they are, that's okay. They might find it easier to let that group go because they've got all these other groups. But where it's narrower and narrower and they've only got a few places, they can respond. That can be a very strong trigger. So if you're where your main narcissistic supply, and for most people it's home, it's not work. Most people it's home, whoever's in their intimate relationships, where that starts to break down, where their sense of who they are as perceived by others starts to break down, their partner questions it or their kids question it, that's a trigger. Because it's literally, they will feel like, I'm going to lose sense of who I am. I need to save myself as quickly as possible. I'll do whatever it takes. There's no even thinking about it.
Where's that line between someone just being emotional or angry or upset and having narcissistic personality disorder?
Even that line between someone just being angry, emotional, upset, and just having narcissistic traits is, the more narcissistic someone is, the less ability they have after the event to reflect and look at their fault and things. Okay, and actually make a change. So narcissistic trait generally means...
However, sorry to jump in, isn't performing narcissistic behaviours then apologizing, then doing it again, then apologizing, then doing it again and apologizing. Yeah. Isn't that a trait of a narcissist?
So if I finished,
sorry.
I would have said, the apology might be there and the right words may be said, but there's no change.
Yeah.
Okay. So
sometimes
you may not
the apology
the
is manipulation,
time.
Isn't it?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
So someone's, come on, everybody flies off the handle at some point.
Yeah.
We have a threshold, but most people will have remorse. And most people, hopefully, we stop and say, okay, well, what could I do differently next time? Let's talk about it. Let me see where I was at fault first. Even if at the end of the day you were right.
Yeah.
How could I have made this better? You know, narcissists might typically, you point out a problem in the relationship, they'll say, no, it's in your head. There's nothing wrong with our relationship. It's perfect. You know, and the gaslighting like that begins, oh, hang on, so am I being cynical about our relationship? Is the problem really with me? This person's really satisfied with our relationship. So it must. Does that make sense? Mm. That there's. The thing is, though, it can happen little by little where you may not notice it. So someone described it to me really well. Actually, it was a solicitor who described it to me really well. The way an abusive person gets intelligent, high-functioning people to not just get into these kinds of relationships but stay is like cooking a frog in cold water. So you throw a frog in a pan of boiling water, it will jump out, right? Obvious. But you put the frog in a pan of cold water and then put it on the hob, the water gets hot slowly. The frog doesn't even notice the water's getting warm because it's going up slowly, and before it knows what's happening, the water's boiling and it's dead, right? So this is why it's, you know, when I've been asked this question before, like people will ask, well, how do I protect myself from getting into that relationship?
There must be some telltale signs that you can pull out.
Yeah. Those telltale, see, there's two things. One is the narcissist themselves, okay? To the degree that your own sense of self-identity is well-preserved and strong, to that degree, they'll be less damaging. So you can come out of a relationship with a narcissist and be relatively still well-preserved, right?
If you're strong.
Yes. If you've had a healthy, you know, healthy past experiences and you've kept good friends, family, etc. in the loop, there will be damage there, but it will be more like a dent than a write-off, okay? If you... also, the other thing is they tend to go for people who are empaths, because the thing is, an empath, they feel what the narcissist is feeling. They understand the pain. They often will tell them what happened to them in childhood. And so one can get caught up in this trap of, okay, well, hang on a minute, but I understand what's wrong and why. So I should forgive them and hope they'll change, right? So these dynamics are also there, and they do play into whether someone stays or goes. But those things that you can look out for is, one, the ability to be insightful and reflective. Two, the endeavor to change. Thirdly, your own. Reflect on yourself. How much am I just passing off or letting go and not discussing with others? Because if you find that you're somebody who usually talks to your friends and you're finding yourself more and more stepping away from your friends to protect that person or to protect your relationship, I would say, you know, be careful, because you can quickly, any relationship, whether it's with a narcissist or not, is in danger of becoming unhealthy if the only person you talk about your relationship is the other person.
Mm. So if a narcissist has got you under full control, how do you get that narcissist to, how do you get them out of your life?
Well, the difficulty is first recognizing that you're being abused, because often when people are being abused, they've lost sight of the fact that they're being abused, because an abuser keeps someone in an abusive relationship by primarily making them believe that it's their fault.
Mm.
So everything becomes justifiable,
yeah.
Right? Oh, okay, I can't trust myself. You know, this is what gaslighting does. Your own trust in yourself breaks down, your own trust in your judgment breaks down. You only trust that person.
Could you just define gaslighting?
So gaslighting is really a form of, it's like smoke and mirrors. They will use ordinary everyday situations to break down your trust in yourself, whether it's leaving the milk out, whether it's cleaning the house, whether it's, you know, having an argument and you've said something, they'll keep breaking you that you didn't say that, you didn't say that, you didn't say that. You're just so exhausted that you're like, okay, fine, I didn't say that. And then you just start believing them on everything for peace.
Right.
And then it grows onto bigger lies. And you just believe what you're told more than your own judgment.
Yeah.
Okay. So I forgot your original question now.
So have I. I'm enjoying it.
Okay.
it was how do you get a narcissist out of your life?
So first of all, I was saying you need to recognize you're being abused, which can take a long time. Okay, it can take time because the way they keep you there is you blame yourself. So if you blame yourself for everything going wrong in your relationship, you're not usually the one thinking I need to leave.
Yeah,
you're thinking, wow, this person's really great for staying with me.
Oh,
you know?
Yeah,
because that's how they make you feel. That you know, I'm doing you a favor by staying in your life.
Okay, so. Let's say you've gone beyond that stage where you know some things are wrong, but of course they've got their claws in you completely. They control you, they own you, they've got your assets, they've got everything. They've got your reputation, they've got blackmail, they've got the lot.
Everything, yes.
How do you get out of that?
So one of the reasons, so once you realize that, often the next question then is, leaving is going to be harder than staying. Because by then you've seen the lies.
Yeah.
You've seen the pain. You've started to see through the cracks and go, oh, wow, this person is not the person that I thought. A lot of my idea of love isn't actually love. It's just they cause a lot of pain, and then relief from the pain feels like love.
Yeah.
Right?
Is that called trauma bonding?
Yeah, in some ways. And also, it's almost like the happiness becomes an absence of pain rather than genuine, true happiness and connection. So it can be tricky. Now, lots of people will say, okay, well, I'll just wait for them to get so fed up. The next time they say they're going to leave, I'll let them walk out the door, because they'll often threaten, you're lucky to have me, I'll walk out, I'll leave. The problem is, if you say, okay, fine, go, they may even make a show of going, but usually they're back.
Yeah.
Because they can't live without that narcissistic supply. I mean, how many people are going to tolerate that? It's taken them years to build you up to that.
Yeah.
They're not going to give it away. So what I would suggest on a practical level is first get yourself some space. And I know people get caught up in property and finance. And yes, it can be a real issue for some people. But if you can find somewhere safe that you can go, even for a few weeks, we could just get your head clear. Because everything is smaller if you take a step away from it. Everything's much bigger when it's right in your face. So just getting some space, if it requires you to block them on your phone, block your emails, whatever it is you need to do, everybody's life is set up differently, to just get some space, even if it's to live somewhere else. And then slowly just start to see if there's some amicable way that you can not have contact. Unfortunately, if you're going through a separation process with a narcissistic person, the more severely narcissistic they are, the harder it's going to be. And the more severely narcissistic they are, the more likely it is you're going to have to get the law involved in some shape or form. Be prepared for a wake-up call, because that's probably when you're going to see the most ugly side of this person, whether it's in business or it's in a relationship. But rest assured that in one sense, it's to your advantage to see the entire ugly side. Because if you don't see that side and the extent that they can go to, it's likely they drag you back in again anyway, right? So that the smoke and mirrors need to be smashed and cleared.
Yeah.
And that's painful.
Yeah.
That's painful, because you've built up your relationship on a completely different ideology.
Yeah.
So you go through the same process of heartbreak, disappointment, feeling like, wow, I invested all this time in someone that I thought was something else. I thought this person loved me. And you go through that same heartbreak as if you were breaking up with somebody who did genuinely love you. And it's not that, see, this is this term love.
Can narcissists actually love?
So everybody has the desire and capacity to give and receive love. The thing is, our mind is like a filter or a mirror or a window, right, through which we perceive and also express. Our mind is the brain is part of the mind, and a lot of the mind is expressed via the brain, but once we understand the mind is bigger and more than the brain, right? So this mind gets our psychological side of ourself develops based on our various interactions. Some of those interactions make that mind clearer. Some of those interactions cloud it, crack it, distort it. And so what ends up happening is whatever we're putting out gets filtered through the mind, and whatever we're receiving. So we may have the genuine desire to give and receive love, but with a personality disorder where that clear glass has become distorted, the expression of love and the receiving of love also gets distorted. And that's what we mean by these maladaptive patterns. You know, so helping, it's like cleaning your window to have treatment and therapy to work on maladaptive patterns, whether they're narcissistic, sociopathic, emotionally unstable, whether you have traits, whether you have the full-blown disorder, anything you have, whatever disorder you have, if it's something that's clouding your judgment, your ability to give and receive love, then that's the whole purpose of your treatment, is to kind of, let's get that mirror as clear as possible, or window as clear as possible.
So are you saying narcissists don't really love the person? They love if they can control and manipulate that person to give them good feelings of self?
Yes and no. So narcissistic personality disorder is a personality disorder. it doesn't mean that that individual as an individual is necessarily bad or of poor character or evil or has no capacity to love. They want to connect. Everybody wants to connect. One of the reasons they've got NPD is because they wanted to connect as a child or as a young person. And
so do they need more love then, is that?
So in one sense, that can help. And then that's what the empath thinks, that if I give this person real love, they might change. And if it's a milder form of knife, there's narcissistic traits, that can help. Going into a relationship with a really healthy person can help somebody who's narcissistic to become quite secure and happier in themselves and not take other people's judgment so harshly. But like I said, the more severe it is, the less it's in the other person's hands. So they can love another person, but their self-preservation takes precedence. And the way their self-preservation takes precedence is maladaptive, as in it will be at the expense of the other person. All of us, we have this innate knowing, I've got to look after myself, right? Survival. Whether it's physically, psychologically, spiritually, there's this I am because I am. You know, you can say I am because I think, but I am because I am, I'm here. Okay, so whatever validates us, makes us feel secure, like we're present, like we have purpose, we're having experience, we will do. A healthy person, where there are not personality disorder traits, will actually notice when a situation or a relationship is drawing them into wanting to behave in maladaptive ways, and they'll go, this isn't healthy for me. This isn't who I am. I will step away from it. That's my way of self-preserving because that's a healthy way to self-preserve. Whereas when you have a personality disorder, your ways of self-preserving are skewed. They're dysfunctional. They will be at the expense of another person because that's what you've learned.
So is it possible for someone with narcissistic personality disorder to self-diagnose that they have it and admit that they've got it and come to you for therapy?
It's very rare that somebody with the full-blown personality
calls you up,
accept it
and goes, Dr. Kang, I'm a hardcore narcissist, I need some help.
No, usually they'll be phoning up saying...
blaming someone else, yes, blaming a partner.
Saying they think I've got narcissistic personality disorder, I'm going to court, can you do me a psychiatric report saying that I don't have it?
Oh, I see. Yeah.
So where there's traits, though, people can get insight that they'll go, you know, Dr. Kang, you know, I was Googling online and I saw this and this. And I'm like, oh, it's good you've brought this up and we can talk about it and look at it, where it may have come from, things they can do. But they have to allow themselves to be in a vulnerable place. I had someone with full-blown narcissistic personality disorder ask me what kind of therapy should I have. And so we were discussing that. I said, but your narcissistic personality disorder is... to such a degree that if you start therapy, it will really break down your sense of who you are and you actually may not be able to cope.
You actually told them that you diagnosed them with it. You told them they've got it.
Yeah.
How did they react to that?
They didn't accept it. but they said, what would be the therapy? And so, you know, what would it look like? So when we spoke about that, they were like, they actually did. They accepted when I said, but if you did it, it will break down your sense of who you are and you may find that very difficult to tolerate. And they opted not to go for therapy because there was this almost knowing that, no, I know that if I can't preserve this sense of who I am, I don't know what's underneath. And that's scary for me.
Mm.
You know, so even that much insight is, I know that. But then at least that can help them to say, okay, well, then maybe I shouldn't enter a relationship right now until I feel
but
safe.
But how can they not enter a relationship when they need people to validate themselves?
Absolutely. So then they try to... not enter, but see, the thing is, this is where we get into ifs and maybes, right? It's very hard as a clinician, your conversation gets beyond that with a narcissist. It's rare that they'll come back to therapy.
Right.
So whereas you can give that advice and say, look, work relationships, etc., they don't damage other people so much. How much can you manipulate someone at work before they fire you, you know, or stop talking to you do you see what I mean? But it's the personal relationships, the close ones. So it depends on degree. And if they've got very severe narcissistic personality disorder, they also find it hard to get close to people anyway.
Yeah.
But yeah, this is a huge topic.
I know, we've spent ages on it already. And I'm not even finished. I've got a couple more on narcissism. No.
Yeah.
Two questions rolled into one. Does every human being have the ability to perform narcissistic traits? And are there certain types of people who have higher narcissistic traits? For example, prime ministers, presidents, entrepreneurs, etc. Two in one.
Good question. So when you look at narcissistic traits, going back to this point of it's about self-preservation, who does the world think I am? When we are hurt, we may notice that in ourselves, that when we're hurt, other people's opinion other than the person who's hurt us may also, we may become more vulnerable to that, more sensitive to criticism, more sensitive to what other people think of us. And we may start wanting to preserve those areas of our life more. We may also find when we're hurt, we feel like our identity has been ripped apart, perhaps a job loss, a relationship breakup, a change in a role in life. Perhaps your body's changed a lot, but something's uprooted your usual sense of identity. You may find yourself defaulting to some of the self-protective mechanisms that the narcissist will.
Like what?
So, for example, at home, if you feel like you've been laid into pretty heavily about your character or something, you may find yourself questioning the other person to a point of what seems like gaslighting.
Right.
You don't trust their judgment. You don't want to trust their judgment.
Yeah.
And then you stop believing them even when they're telling you something that's true. And you make them doubt themselves. Or you might find yourself taking shelter of more superficial things to find a sense of identity. See, there is a...
Do they also lash out? You know that saying, hurt people hurt people?
Yeah.
I see that a lot. So the more hurt someone is, the more they might try and hurt other people.
Absolutely. You lose almost your impulse control.
Right.
The usual impulse control you have becomes more vulnerable, more fragile.
Yeah.
Right? It's like a self-defense.
Yes.
But it becomes an attack.
Yes.
And then we've got this modern day phenomenon of people having many identities because of digital media.
Do you mean sexual identities
or
just general
identities?
No, you could
have lots of identities.
Harry says there's 75 gender identities now.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
So, yeah, a study I heard.
Someone
said that.
Do you, or do you mean profiles?
Profiles.
So, yeah.
But a profile is like an identity. You post certain things on one profile and maybe have a different tone of voice there, have a different image on another profile. And so you see, you know, especially young people, for them it's becoming quite normal and organic to have one group of friends they're like this with, another group of friends they're like this with. I mean, it's hard enough
That's
to keep
confusing.
One identity. Can you imagine keeping
confusing.
It? Right. So then your sense of who you are starts to get further and further away from you. It's now in the hands of so many others. So then what do you start
right.
doing?
Right, so you start losing control of that
identity.
You start
losing control, and then the narcissistic traits develop as a way to protect yourself because you don't want anyone having that much power, but you're the one who's given it all away.
Is there an argument, not coming from a trained therapy point of view, but is there an argument that the way to relinquish all of these feelings is to let go of false identities of self? I am one. I am the universe. I am me. I am nothing but that. Surely then you have nothing to defend to the world against.
So I mean, this is what I find intriguing about spirituality and mental health. I mean, at its essence, spirituality is about who am I beyond what the world sees? Who am I beyond my roles? Beyond just this physicality, beyond my personality, right?
Yeah.
Who's that witness, the person watching everything as my body's
the
changed?
The observer.
Yes, the observer. Now, you can go into as much detail as you want with that. You can bring other spiritual hierarchies, etc., in, or relationships. Mm. But our essence is, you know, that... And actually, mental health research shows that people who have a sense of self or invest some time in developing a sense of self separate from what other people make them to be, or because think about it, all our identities are rooted either in a relationship or a function, aren't they? Even our personality, you can only figure out someone's personality based on interacting with them. You can't tell by someone just sitting there quietly.
Yeah.
So when you have a sense of self which is separate to all of that, it gives you psychological resilience, an ability to be more present, enjoy the present moment, and actually greater security in yourself. We also see greater, quicker recovery rates.
Right.
And less vulnerability to mental health problems.
Mm. Are there ways people who are in denial narcissists or have narcissists around them, are there ways for them to care less of what other people think about them? And is that a good way to combat narcissism?
Are you talking about the narcissist themselves or the people they are there in relationships with?
Let's talk about the people who have had narcissistic experiences, i.e. with other narcissists, because we've already kind of highlighted that a narcissist doesn't admit they're a narcissist. So if someone's listening and they've got narcissistic personality disorder, but they aren't admitting it, they can't hear this conversation,
they? They're probably thinking of someone else.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah.
They're probably thinking of the
22 exes of theirs.
Yes.
Yeah, but not looking at themselves. But clearly, if any of us have had an experience with a narcissist, which I've had a very strong experience with one, there must have been a sense of being concerned about what they or others thought about us. Otherwise, as soon as we saw the signs, we could have let them go. Mm-hmm. So how do we deal with that concern for what other people think about us when it holds us back so much?
So usually the concern about what other people think about us isn't coming from something we already had. It's usually the narcissist has planted that in your head because they've separated you from the people who you care
about. But maybe the fact that you care so much about what people think is how you attracted the narcissist in the first place. By the way, I am allowed to interrupt.
Yes, that's fine. It's your show. Yeah. yes, that could be.
I hope interrupting isn't a narcissistic quality.
Well, then I'm kidding. Well, I guess interviews are also partly performance, aren't they?
Well, it's just have some fun, you know.
Yes,
yeah, sorry, absolutely. We've got three loops open now, if you can remember what they are.
Yeah, so one is you're asking how do you take space, psychological space, from a narcissist if you're in that relationship.
Yeah, and not be concerned about what they or other people think about you. Because if you weren't, you'd just let them go, surely.
Yeah, but if you're already really concerned about what they think about you, what they're going to tell other people they think about you, and that everybody believes what they say.
Because that's one of their weapons, isn't it?
Absolutely.
Talking about you. And then you have this great big fear of what they're saying about you.
And they'll lie.
Yeah, of course
they will lie.
And then the only way you can stop them doing it is by bringing them back.
Yes.
To be your friend and lover again.
Or
whatever.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Or pacifying them.
Yeah.
Okay? Or giving them back the power that they're looking for, that they seem to think you've taken away. So, but the point I was trying to make is often it's got to that point because they have isolated you from the voices and people in your life who would help you to have clarity. So what I would say is, how do you take psychological space? It's just, if you found yourself stepping away from friends and family that maybe you used to speak to regularly and you found I haven't spoken to them in months or even years, reach out. You don't have to, even in a healthy relationship, your partner doesn't have to know every single nitty-gritty bit of every conversation that you have with your friends and family. But the narcissist makes you feel obliged to do that for them. Who did you see? When did you see them? What did you talk about? Did you mention me? Did you know what I mean? What do they think of me? I really like them, you know, as a way to draw information out. You don't have to. And start reconnecting with those people who give you your sense of who you are back. Mm. And that way you can start getting that psychological space. And as you get your internal resilience back, then making decisions about physically taking space, financially taking space, making a long-term, because actually the only way really to relate to a narcissist is to not relate to them. You actually, the more severe they are, the best thing to do is just have no contact at all.
That's the only way to beat them, is to cut them off.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's some things just that have to just be chopped off.
Yeah.
There's no repair, you know, there's because they don't know how to repair. They can pretend for a little while. But that's what I'm saying, the degree of severity is important. But get that psychological space first by bringing back people in your life slowly, one by one. Even if it's just one, it's amazing what one conversation can set off.
Has social media perpetuated narcissism?
Yeah, I mean,
has it made you busy in your practice?
Social media hasn't made me busy in my practice. It's. I don't think it's brought about new diagnoses or anything like that. But I think it's an added stressor for people. One is the multiple profiles and having to maintain appearances for so many different people. Secondly, the amount of time you spend on digital media gets you away from real things.
Has it made people more insecure, you know, about how they look to other people?
Absolutely, because what you often are projecting on your digital profile has been filtered, altered, is a snippet, isn't often a complete, it's an incomplete representation of yourself.
Yeah.
And you may get you know, and if somebody's not giving you a heart or isn't giving you a thumbs up or is, you know, you're thinking, oh, wow, they didn't like it or they didn't like me. But they've only seen that much of you.
Yeah.
And then we start to evaluate ourselves on what we think somebody else thinks about 1% of ourselves.
Yeah.
What about the other 99% that you never showed them?
Yeah.
You see what I mean? So, I mean, even in my practice, I know we've got this culture now of having therapy online and having psychiatric assessments and stuff online. And I'll be honest, I've not been one of these clinicians who's stuck to doing much of that since we've all gone back to face-to-face, because I do think, you know, if we were only meant to interact head and shoulders up, that's how we would have looked when we were born.
Yeah,
There is something, you lose something by just speaking to people through a screen. You lose the full experience of their personality, the nonverbal communication, the eye contact.
Mm.
And so what you're presenting of yourself on digital media is such a snapshot, but if then you measure your worth based, you know, 100% of your worth or 50% of your worth, even 70% of your worth based on how someone judges 1% of you, and you ignore the rest, it can make life really difficult.
Mm.
And there's a whole host of stuff with digital media. There's the whole blue light thing, your posture, the fact that you've got 1,000 things stimulating you at the same time. It creates almost like an ADHD type brain, even when you never had it. You know, there's a bunch of stuff. So I would say it's complicated matters more rather than brought about new diagnoses.
Mm. Have you ever been in a relationship with a narcissist?
Oh, that's a very personal question. Yes.
Well, it sounds personal, but it's actually not. And so I'll tell you my driving for the question is that I can imagine one gains great experience from about narcissists by being in a relationship with one. And I can imagine that that could drive one to want to help other people deal with narcissism.
Especially when you get out of it.
Yeah, exactly.
When you're in it, you ain't got a clue.
No. So... tell us about it.
The thing is, this is where I really do believe when people are doing what they are good at, what they enjoy, what they're almost designed for, right? What they bring into this world. There's a reason, because you're not just serving others with your purpose, but there's something in there that actually improves you. And I have to say, for me, it was actually through my conversations with patients, I'd find myself saying things to them, like, hang on a minute. That's happening to me too.
Oh, so you were in a narcissistic relationship while you were a practicing clinician?
Yes.
Oh, so it wasn't like you had a relationship and it, you got out of it and you're like, right, I've got to help people now.
No.
Oh, because that must have been surreal for you.
Yes, that was. Yeah. Because on the one level, there was insight and theory and objectivity and being able to spot it from a mile away in another person. And then it's just, the day came and I was like, well, hang on a minute, what is going on? This is like, I recognize that here and that here and that. I was like, whoa, okay. And then for me, that's what I mean by you need to first take psychological space. And that's when I realized, I thought, okay, my cycle of that part of my life where I had those people who I used to have the most trust in had suddenly been, you know, over a period of time, there'd been a space created. That was the first thing I did.
Was that space created by you letting them go because you chose your partner or your partner forcing you to push them away?
Both, by changing my perception of what they thought of me.
Right.
You know, imagine being literally persuaded that the people who actually love me the most don't think very much of me.
Wow. And why do they do that? So that they can control your behavior.
Absolutely.
And you having other friendships gives them less control because those friendships might control you more than they can control you.
Also, those relationships might make me realize more quickly the nature of...
Might expose the narcissist.
Yeah. But hang on a minute, that's not right. He shouldn't be saying that. He shouldn't be doing that. That's not normal. But I had the slow cooked frog process very much.
Right.
I was very young at the time.
Yeah.
And stuff. So it's, you know, when you're young, you
have... How did you get out of it?
It was very difficult, but, you know, I refer back to this thing where you have to have the smoke and mirrors broken. It was painful. It was painful because I remember the whole process when everything just finally became clear for me is... I spent a lot of time in the beginning blaming myself and really thinking, oh, it's so bad. They must be hurting so much. Everything is my fault. I'm causing them so much pain. But actually, I know I'm doing something good for them because they're not going to have a chance to change if I don't break this vicious cycle, right? And then, because I first thought, oh, it's just an anger issue. Honestly, I did not think there were any lies. I did not think there were. I thought that I was the only person in the world this person was honest with.
Wow.
Yes.
So you saw lies to other people, yes, but you just didn't think that they would be doing the same to you.
Exactly. I saw lie after lie with other people, but with me, I was just like, you know, they're only honest with me. I'm their special person in their life. So I went from blaming myself to suddenly hearing all these lies and seeing how they were playing out the whole separation. Mm. And I was like, oh my God, I was stunned by the lie. I was actually still remember feeling stunned. And then I saw the lies break down and them getting caught out. And eventually, then it was just like,
so what was attractive about them? Because there must be attractive traits of narcissists, otherwise we wouldn't be attracted to them.
Well, the thing is, so if you look at the stages of a relationship.
Oh, there are stages.
Yes.
Oh, go on then.
So the first is idealization. Okay, they idealize you.
So idealize, you know, or idolize?
Idealize.
Okay.
Right? Okay, so they will quite literally take the Hollywood or Bollywood template of romance, especially when you're young. That's all you know, right? Fairy tales, Bollywood, Hollywood, whatever movie scene you're into, TV series, that kind of sweep you off
your
feet.
So they completely romance you, is that what you mean?
Yeah, love bombing, right?
Love
and also
bombing, right.
Connecting with you on a level that you think nobody else can. Because the thing is, a narcissist can read people very well for their self-protection. Think about it. If you're growing up or in an environment where you have to protect yourself, you've got to prepare yourself for the next assault. You don't want to trigger an assault from, you know, whether it's verbal, emotional. So you're hypersensitive to the degree that you know. So they can read people very well as long as it's in their best interest. Okay.
Yeah.
So they understand you to a degree. You're just like, wow, nobody's ever understood me this way. Now, this is the difference between a manipulative person and somebody who actually cares about you. And someone who cares about you will also read you very well, but they'll use what they read to help you. Somebody who's going to manipulate you and abuse you, whatever their diagnosis is whatever disorder they have or don't have, they will use what they know about you to break you down. Okay, so the idea, so just you're just swept off your feet. Okay, and when you're young, I think it's
or you're an empath,
yeah, or both.
Yes, yeah. You're fucked in if you're both of those.
Right. Oh, I have to, you know, it's kind of like, wow, you know, this wonderful, loving person, and swept off my feet. I'm never going to get anything like this again. This is what the movies talk about.
Right, yeah.
So you give yourself, you let your guard down complete, and you also start feeling a bit like their protector because you understand them and the trouble they went through and the difficulty they went through as well. And so from there, the idealization, and then they then start to, I guess, break you down.
Is this stage two we're in now?
Yeah, stage two, the kind of breaking down, degradation, destruction of your own judgment and perception.
And why do they need to do that? Why can't they just stay in the romance phase?
It's really hard to keep up because it's about preserving themselves,
right.
And
so it's an act that they just can't keep going.
They can't keep going. They're even attracted to it because to be that closely connected to someone, right?
Yeah, so it's quite exciting for them.
It's exciting. But to maintain it requires maturity, care, give and take.
Yeah.
And that's hard to do because they're scared. Oh, no, this person's going
to
hurt me, or this person's not going to be around, or this person's going to, if I don't keep the upper hand, then somehow I might get exploited again like I was when I was younger, for example. So then that whole breakdown starts slowly you start doubting yourself again, moving away from friends, etc. And two things can happen. One is you become a brilliant narcissistic supply for that person. You continue to supply them. They feel powerful. They're powerful by association. They're powerful. You might be a great trophy for them, etc.
Right.
And so, but they have to keep you there because any intelligent, successful trophy is going to kind of start playing.
Figure it out.
This isn't right. So then the whole gaslighting manipulation starts.
So and can narcissists have a long-term relationship then? Is it actually possible?
It is possible, but like I said, this is the whole thing of that narcissistic abuse cycle. They can even have children, and then you get kids who are raised by a narcissistic parent, which is a whole, you know, that really can really perpetuate this whole narcissistic cycle. Often, people who are narcissists have had one or two or both parents who are the narcissists or sociopaths or have overlapping traits of both. So, so once your kind of self-trust, self-worth, self-judgment is destroyed and you stay and you're caught in this kind of narcissistic cycle and cycle of abuse, where you're kept there more out of guilt and feeling a sense of responsibility because everything's your fault. But if you clock on, so you either stay and you end up having a long-term relationship, it's very far down the road perhaps after you've had kids and stuff like that.
That must be so exhausting.
It's exhausting. And then it can be exhausting. It can, you know, destroy people in terms of it can really eat away at them, give them other mental health disorders. They have problems usually with the kids, etc., physical health problems. Or you clock and you say, okay, I'm going to get out of this. And so then they try to discard you. Right, and they hope that either trying to discard you will make you stay, or discarding you will hurt you enough that they get some sort of power from it. Right.
Yeah.
So at this point, you know, there may be more extreme expressions of aggression or violence. There may be greater threats. There may even be lies spread about you. They'll attempt to spread lies to people, completely made up, but because. And it can be quite frightening for the person going through it because you have this thing, everybody believes them because they're so charming and polite. And they can be charming and polite for 5 minutes. So everybody who's ever met your partner tells you, oh, you're so lucky. They're so nice.
Yeah.
You know, and you're like, how do I tell people that this person's really abusive?
Yeah,
you know,
wow.
It's easy when it's on the surface, right? But even then, it's easier when it's on the surface because people say, oh, you know, your partner's a bit of whatever.
Yeah.
Why don't you leave him? But you're kind of like, it's my fault. That's why I say it's my fault. I did this. That's why I did that.
Right.
And I'm going to change him or her. Mm-hmm. So even then, because of it's the manipulation that keeps a person there. Nobody stays in relationships unless they're manipulated to. If I told you, oh, you know, I'm going to send you on a date with someone who's going to beat you, take your money, break down your sense of self. It's going to shout and scream at you, tell you you're useless, never let you go. Would you go, thanks, Chandler?
That's not a good pitch.
You wouldn't. That's not a pitch, is it?
No.
So why would you stay? Only if you've been manipulated into thinking that that is the best you can get and you're responsible for it.
Yeah. Are there differences between narcissistic men and narcissistic women?
So with narcissistic men, so you see narcissistic PD more in men than in women. It's almost double prevalence.
Really?
Yeah, because narcissistic men will have more likely to have an overlap with sociopathic or psychopathic traits because those traits, the self-protection is more externalized, okay? With women, the self-protection is more internalized. So you might have narcissism more likely with a borderline personality disorder or emotionally unstable personality disorder. So the self-protection is maladaptive and internalized, so you're more likely to get suicide attempts and self-harm and et cetera, and emotional dysregulation, which is, yes, internalized and acted on upon oneself, but will also be inflicted on partners, but in a different way, more of fear of abandonment.
Mm. How did you learn all this shit? So you must have had a long career. You must have seen a lot of people in your practice. How did you learn all this stuff?
So, I mean, I don't know if you're asking me academically, if you're asking me just generally.
Well, why would I choose? Why can't I have both?
Both? Okay, yeah. So a psychiatrist training is, you know, you do your 6 years at medical school and then you do your what we used to call my day house job. So you do work in surgery, medicine, internal medicine, etc. Then you specialize. So I specialized in psychiatry, which is another 7 years training, but you're working at the same time. So you're going from junior doctor to registrar, then to consultant. Over the course of all of that training, you learn the how a person operates biologically, psychologically, socially. And then for me personally also, I feel like because of, I guess, my spiritual practices and spiritual background, there's that element of it. And then there's experience, what you actually see in the clinic room, because books can only take you so far. And I learn a lot from my colleagues. I learn a lot from my patients themselves. Mm.
You run a full weekly practice, do you? You know,
I give lots of talks on these subjects and these topics.
Well, how I found you was like a big video of yours, about 8 million views it was.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. Yeah, you
no,
don't
I
even
don't
know.
Think so.
It's definitely you. It's definitely you. That's how I found you.
I don't think I've got any video with 8 million views.
You have. The video is talking about the differences between a narcissist, a sociopath, and a psychopath. That's where I got the first question from.
Oh, right, okay.
There aren't any other Dr. Chetna Kangs around, are there? But
I don't think so. That's quite an unusual name.
Yeah, 100% that's where I found you.
Oh, all right then.
So maybe someone has recorded your talk.
Possibly.
Yeah. There you go. So you're a viral sensation.
Okay, I had
maybe
no
going
idea.
To be a double viral sensation.
Who knows?
Now.
Who knows? I thought you'd found me on Will Young's podcast.
Yeah, I did. Yeah. Simultaneously.
Simultaneously.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah. So I can't remember which one was first.
Okay. Yeah, because we. Yeah. I mean, his podcast was specifically on narcissism.
Yeah, it was, and that is what I told you.
But I don't know how much of a disruptor I've been on your show called The Disruptors. We've had quite a polite conversation.
I'm going to
so
YouTube,
far.
Right? I'm going to YouTube this. I don't normally do this live. Let's have a look. YouTube. I want you to see this.
Well, as is probably evident, I don't really count my value based on how many YouTube hits I have, but it's nice.
I wish
to
I
know.
Could do the same
yeah,
thing, you know.
It's different, you know.
Talk about. Identity disorder.
No.
I feel amazing when we have millions of views and depressed when we don't.
But the thing is, that's how you measure your particular business success, though, isn't it? So
it's that's one of the measures.
One of them, yeah.
Yeah,
so then that's different. It doesn't necessarily mean you'll measure your self-worth, although it's a fine line,
yeah.
Isn't it? If you can't find it, leave it. Maybe it is someone else. Maybe it's not me.
I'll find it. It's all right. Well, it doesn't matter. We're here. Is that I actually am just randomly interesting. I had... Tiger King, Carol Baskin on the show from okay. Tiger King. And we got to the end and she was like, oh, I've just realised you're not who I thought you were. And I agreed the show based on thinking you were someone else.
Oh, right. Okay.
But we still did it.
Well, I know who you are. Yeah. I know who you are. Because I had good look once you contacted me.
And on that note of having a good look... You said you watched my Andrew Tate interview just
I
before you
to
got
it, the
in.
Third
okay,
part, yes.
Sorry. Watched, listened, same
yes.
thing, you know. So I wanted to ask you the question that has to be asked when it comes to Andrew Tate and this subject. Andrew Tate believes that depression isn't real. What does Dr. Chetna Kang think?
I found his response interesting because he went into quite a few areas when it comes to depression. And I agree with some of his points. With other points, the ones that I don't agree with, I think it's because there's a gap in his knowledge about depression, but that's okay because I don't expect him to be a clinician. You know, he's a person with his own opinions who happens to have a lot of influence, so I guess I will respond to your question. So I think the first thing that he says, one of the things that struck me is when he said that you're depressed because your reality is depressing. Okay. Now, how do we perceive reality? How do we create reality? We use our bodies, we use our minds, we use our five working senses. And, you know, I think earlier I was commenting that our mind is more than our brain, but certainly there is a connection between the mind and the brain. So just like a change in perhaps neurochemistry of the brain will lead to a change in our mind, equally, we do something with our mind, like a positive thought, it will lead to a reciprocal change in the brain. Also, certain hormones, nutritional deficits in the body can change your mood because they may cut off supply to a part of your brain that mediates your mood, right? You want to go another angle altogether. We can also say some of your mood is also mediated, especially if you have a spiritual practice, by your spiritual practice. It comes from within, from a different place. So then it just stands to logic and reason that if the body or the brain can undergo some sort of disease process, that can affect your mood. So you can have an illness called depression. Everybody feels sad, and I totally appreciate when you're feeling sad, it colors your reality. It colors your ability to affect your reality and change your reality. But sadness is a feeling, it's an experience, it's a helpful and valuable experience. Depression is an illness where something that is part of your normal existence, like sadness, has got to an intensity, a frequency, and a length of time which is now interfering with your ability to affect change in your reality. Okay, this is why we talk about it as an illness. And not, and where he's wrong is where he says, oh, I don't believe in anything where somebody tells you it's a disease that can't be cured and is going to be there forever and you can't do anything about it. I don't think I've ever told anyone that depression can't be treated and is going to be there forever. In fact, most, the vast majority of mental illnesses are episodic, they're transient, they're there to actually help you grow into becoming someone better than you were before even you got unwell. Because what would be the point of going back to how you were before you were unwell? Because clearly that wasn't working for you. Otherwise you wouldn't have gotten unwell. And plus, you know, mental health problems are generally multifactorial. So it's not helpful when we tell someone, oh, your illness doesn't exist. It's all in your head. Okay, yes, it's in your head, but part of your head is also brain, part of it's physiological in your body, part of it's psychological, relationships, there may be spiritual, there may be financial. If you don't have enough money, that's stressful. There's only so much stress a person can take. And if it, that stress gets you to a point where you can't affect change in your reality, that's where it's like, okay, I need to treat your symptoms of excessive sadness, excessive loneliness, excessive negative thinking, not being able to get up in the morning, not eating properly, not sleeping properly. Because if you're in that state, you can't do the basics of life, let alone sit there going to start change the world, right? So medication with mental health disorders are often there to alleviate your symptoms so you can then start affecting change in the other aspects of your reality and heal, whether that comes with the support of a therapist or not, because not everybody's psychologically minded. Not everybody does well with therapy. You know, if someone is not psychologically minded, I don't just blanket go, you need to go see a therapist. That's not going to work for them, and I think they're better off going to a coach or hitting the gym or going for a massage because they carry all their stress in their body. I will tell them that. So yes, there is an element of truth in you're depressed because your reality is depressing, but equally someone's reality can be picture perfect and you can still get depression, because if there's an imbalance in your body or your brain, or there's been a big shift in your sense of identity, that can create symptoms in you that can limit your ability to affect change, whether that's anxiety, depression, psychosis, whatever it is, but it's there for you to really take stock and prioritize. What was it about my life before this that wasn't working for me that's got me to where I am now?
So I'm actually really enjoying being in the epicenter of this conversation. And it, I think it needs to be thrashed out. So we'll thrash it out, then we'll do a quick fire round. So as I sit here, I'm quite torn, because in this very room a few weeks ago, I interviewed Craig Harrison, who for many years held the world record for the longest sniper kill. And he was in Iraq, Harry, and Afghanistan. And it was absolutely clear he was physically traumatized. And he would visibly bawl his eyes out or visibly get angry. And he's been diagnosed with chronic PTSD. He's tried to take his life. He says he's sad every day. And looking at him, I'm not a doctor and you don't need to be, to know that there is, of course, mental, but almost physical trauma. So looking at Craig made me think that if someone wants to diagnose depression, it's sat right there, and he's not well, he's ill. And then you've got what Andrew Tate is saying, and I obviously flew out to Dubai and spent hours with him, and I think he makes some really good points. His point being that, let's start with sadness before we move into depression, but sadness, I'm going to add some of my suggestions to this. I'm not putting words into his mouth, but he said that essentially he believes in depression, but he doesn't buy into that reality himself. Mm-hmm. And if he feels negative emotions, he does something about it, and he knows he has the ability to change his reality by how he perceives sadness. And I think all human beings, most human beings, unless there's something physically really wrong with them, have the ability to do that. So just before they got to that line that you said where they can't impact change, there was a point where they were before that line where they still could.
Yes.
And they were sad.
Yes.
So I don't think his message is particularly wrong, that part of it. I think it's actually quite empowering. They just love to hate him. And he likes to use sound bites that get the attention, like depression isn't real. But he might not have said that. That might have been a thumbnail that someone put on YouTube. And then I sit in the middle with like, well, is sadness or depression simply a quite an extreme emotion, just like happiness and elation are? And as human beings, we can skill ourselves up better to know how to understand what emotions are and manage those emotions.
100%.
So, because one of my mentors taught me that all emotions are a feedback to the environment. Keep you safe, give you reward. So all emotions are necessary, yet some medicine is trying to soften or dull emotions, but all emotions are necessary, otherwise they wouldn't exist. Emotions are feedback in reaction to the environment to keep you safe or reward you for moving towards pleasure. And illness is the opposite of wellness, which is feedback from your body that something is out of balance in you. And I like to believe those things, even if I'm a bit delusional about them, rather than just popping pills that I get diagnosed from someone who doesn't understand that world. They might be medically trained, but they don't understand that. Because I can still make the decision. I can still take some kind of control. Now, obviously, if I walk back home, my dad was hanging from the ceiling through a rope, I can't say that wouldn't traumatize me, and I can't say that couldn't kick in a depression. But I have got a dad who is bipolar. And so I've experienced this. So I've said a lot of stuff. What are your instant thoughts on all of that?
Well, my job's done. I can leave now.
Well, they're my theories. They're not me.
This is the thing. Emotions are a barometer. All emotions are useful. And actually, one of the talks I often get asked to do is, what does good mental health look like? And I think that's a better question to ask than, what does mental illness look like?
Well, good mental health isn't disowning negative emotions, is it?
No, but we have a culture all over the world where push it down, don't talk about
man
it.
Man up.
Man up, yeah.
Put your big girl pants on.
Yeah, and even for women and men, the way you're allowed to express your emotions is very much dictated by society, you know? Yeah. So I know we're trying to change things. So this whole idea of, what does good mental health look like? Somebody who has good mental health allows them to feel all their emotions. And the reason they allow themselves to feel all their emotions, because they're safe in the knowledge that all emotions are self-limiting. They will come down at some point. So you're going to sit there perpetuating it, right? Mm. So we have this amazing ability with our intelligence to misuse it and live in a world that's not actually happening to us.
Yeah, and live inside your own head and in your own feelings.
Exactly,
you mean.
Right. And make those feelings worse rather than accepting, I'm feeling like this. What are these feelings trying to tell me?
Yeah, that question.
There's no such thing as bad feelings and good
feelings.
Let's
pause and say that again, because I think it's really powerful. What are these feelings trying to tell me?
Absolutely, because they are a barometer.
Yeah.
Okay.
So as soon as we say that, we can make sense of what the negative feelings are and not draw and sink into
negative
them.
Negative feelings, no such thing. There's no such thing as bad feelings, good feelings.
I actually agree,
positive,
yeah. I do agree,
they're
yeah.
just feelings.
They're feelings.
Like, there's hot and cold.
We've labelled them negative.
It's not that cold is bad and hot is
good.
No,
we've labelled them negative.
If you're feeling cold, you welcome the sunshine.
Yeah.
If you're too hot, you're kind of like, sun,
and if
get
you're
away.
Threatened, you want negative feelings. Negative feelings.
Yes, you want to have that fight or flight response if somebody's attacking you.
Yeah.
If you didn't, I mean, imagine telling someone, I'm going to switch off your whole adrenaline response.
Yeah.
What the bloody hell would be the point in that?
Yeah.
You know, well, I'm going to switch off your sadness. Why would you
Isn't
want to do that?
Isn't that what a lot of medication does, though?
No. So,
really?
This is what I'm going to explain.
Or dumbs it down.
So, you've asked me a lot of questions.
I have. I'm enjoying this. This is good. You've spoken a lot.
I know.
Carry on. Go on.
Bet your match. No. Okay, so, what was I saying? So, good mental health. First of all, you allow yourself to feel everything because you're not scared, because you're reassured in the fact that every emotion is self-limiting. There's only so long you can biologically maintain a particular emotion unless you decide to perpetuate it, okay?
Yeah.
So it is in your hands to some degree. Then the other thing is, what this allows is that it allows your emotions to be more regulated, so they will be appropriate to circumstance and they'll be appropriate to time. You will get angry at the person you're supposed to get angry at rather than the other person who's done nothing to you.
Yeah, I've forgiven you for being 30 minutes late, so I've just already let that go.
Well, you weren't very clear with the address or the parking, mate.
but I'm not your PA.
I'm not your PA, you know.
But I've let it go.
That's all right. I didn't know there was anything to forgive. I apologize. Okay. So anyway, where were we? So yes, so you get, so you can read your emotions more clearly because you allow them space. They come up at the right time. Okay. And they're manageable. All right. Think about emotions like Coca-Cola in a bottle. You just open the bottle when it needs to. You can pour it in the glass. You can drink. That Coke is available for you to drink. You shake that bottle, shake it, shake it. You open that lid, it's useless to you. That Coke's going everywhere. It's just foam. It doesn't taste the same. You know what? So this is the thing. By having a culture of...
That's a good analogy.
You're not allowed to feel certain emotions, and other emotions are you know, what we aspire for, to be happy all the time.
Right,
you know?
Yeah. Like the personal development industry can be a bit like that,
can't it?
That's
how they make their money, right? That happiness industry. It's actually why... If you were feeling a state of elation all of the time, it would stop feeling like elation.
Yeah.
You know, there's
and it become an addiction that you always need to chase that emotion.
Right. So emotions are dynamic. There's, you know, this cartoon Inside Out shows it perfectly, that the other feelings, especially happiness, is trying to put sadness in a little corner, when actually sadness helps make the real memories of a person experience.
Yeah.
You know, along with happiness and fear and disgust.
Like listening to sad music, that sadness is actually quite an enjoyable feeling in some ways.
It can be, yes. Yeah. But when you keep pushing down, pushing down, pushing down, then what happens? It bubbles up. It either goes into your body as a physical illness, or it comes out in a...
So the body is giving you feedback that you are suppressing emotions.
Yes.
Now,
think about it also as pain. Pain in the body. People often find body analogies easier to understand. We don't push down pain. I mean, some people do. Oh, I've got to ignore it, forget it. But if you ignore the warning sign too much, it develops into something more. If you catch it early, you can ask yourself, well, why is my knee hurting?
So pain's also feedback.
Pain's feedback. Yeah. Everything's feedback. Yeah. Okay? You want to even look at this spiritually. We're always getting a message.
Yeah.
Someone's always looking out for us somewhere, you know? And so it's just listen.
Yeah.
You know, just listen. And if you listen... and aren't scared of your body, aren't scared of your mind, then you can prevent things from escalating to disease, whether it's physical or psychological. But when you are at a diseased point, then you need the cure, but you also need symptom control, okay?
Yeah.
If somebody comes to me with, an infection that's causing them pain, I could easily go, okay, well, here's the antibiotics for your infection, off you go. Now, the problem with that is cures usually take time to heal.
Yeah.
And symptoms can linger. Sometimes your symptoms might be so strong you stop taking the cure because either you think it's not working or your symptoms have just derailed you. Your pain is so bad you've forgotten to take your antibiotics. So you've got to control the pain as well. So same with where if somebody's pain, psychological pain, has got to a point where it's now led to a mental disorder, right? They need treatment, control of the symptoms whilst they're going about addressing the underlying things that have caused what's going on, the signals they missed, the trauma they didn't address, the self-care they didn't give themselves, the meals they missed, the sleep they deprived themselves of. Am I making sense?
Yeah. Sorry to just jump in there. It's just Harry was looking a bit... We've been kicked out of here loads of times.
Is all of this going to be in the podcast?
Yeah. We don't really edit it out.
I noticed that.
Remember I said the feisty bits are good. So yeah, we don't... Now I like to keep it all in. And unless you've... there's anything you really want to come out.
It's more of a real experience.
Yeah, it'd be more enjoyable. Let's do a quick fire round.
Oh, God.
One more quick thing. I probably shouldn't open this loop, but fuck it. I'm going to do it anyway. Is there an argument that much of Big Pharma, though, is only treating the symptoms and not the cure?
Yes, which is why...
And it's financially incentivized too. Even if it's not nefarious, its reward of profit is symptom, not cure.
I think less so in this country than in... other countries, which,
like
the States, for example, because healthcare there is very privatized. Yeah. There's incentives there for doctors to prescribe certain things. We don't have that in this country. Even if you're in private practice in this country, you've spent so long in the NHS where the clinical care of the patient trumps the financial reward that even when going into private practice, you think with a clinical mindset anyway. So I think less so, but since the base of most pharmaceutical companies is in the States, then yes, to some degree, I agree. But I wouldn't say that prescribers think like that. At least I can say that safely for this country. I mean, I will even have patients where I take them off medicine when they come to me because I feel they've been put on too much. And, you know...
Yeah, I try not to take any.
Yeah, but if you
it depends what you've got, doesn't it?
Yeah,
if you've got a headache,
it's
easier not to than if you've got cancer.
But I'm also firm on firm on, okay, if I think that someone's symptoms have got to a point where they're actually stopping them from affecting change in their reality, like, let's address the symptoms. These are the things you need to address underlying it. Go off and do those things as your symptoms. And they find, oh, because that feeling of sadness isn't as strong, or the anxiety isn't as, you know, stomach-wrenching, I can now eat properly, sleep properly, go and have these helpful conversations, reprioritize my work-life schedule, work on this relationship, and or address trauma from the past. And as you relieve that pressure, then you don't need that. It's like removing the plaster off a broken leg. Your leg's healed straight. Mm. The plaster's not meant to be there forever. So all this prescribing for 20, 30, 40 years and just leaving someone on a repeat prescription, I'm really not into that at all.
Right, let's do the quickfire round. All right, then. Let's go. Have you ever used filters on social media and filtered any images of yourself?
I don't use social media that much, but yeah, I reckon once or twice I've probably used the cool setting on the camera rather than the what it comes out as.
I never have.
Have you not?
No, maybe I should.
But
no,
you're
I
blinged
shouldn't.
Up with your jacket though.
Yeah, exactly. It just takes off my face. Yeah, my aging face. Have you ever been accused of being a narcissist?
Yes, by a narcissist.
I think that's their classic
thing.
It
is.
Yeah.
It is.
Yeah. Right, we're going to do the spot the narcissist round.
Of course.
About 15 to 30 seconds on each one. Is Amber Heard, Johnny Depp, Amber Heard, is Amber Heard a narcissist?
You know what? I have to say that is one case I didn't look closely at. My understanding was she was emotionally unstable personality disorder, but I don't know.
Okay. Is Andrew Tate a narcissist?
I had a feeling you were going to ask me stuff like this. Do you know what? It's very hard to assess what I know. People get a lot of YouTube hits and likes on YouTube or Instagram, whatever, for doing pieces like this. One of the reasons I stay away from them is what people present to the public can be quite different to what they're like in private. And really assessing what traits somebody has, or what personality disorder or disorder someone has. And you know, I've got some famous clients, etc. And the reason I can diagnose them is not because I know what's going on in the public for them. I can get that off any piece of news. It's what they tell me privately.
So, give us your expert opinion then, if Andrew Tate is a narcissist from what you've seen.
I've only heard that third part of the interview with you. And based on that third part, no, he doesn't strike me as a narcissist.
Is Cristiano Ronaldo a narcissist?
I don't know. I've only heard his name from my nephew who loves him.
I told you. By the way, these rounds, this is a bit of fun as
I know,
well.
I'm not sweating. I'm having fun with it too.
Yeah, okay.
At least I've heard of the people you've said.
Yeah. Well, nearly. Yeah. This is more a generic question, but he's been on the show and he's a person of great fascination at the moment. What do you think of Jordan Peterson? You don't know Jordan Peterson. That's actually a better answer than whatever the answer would have been.
Sorry.
Wow, there's someone on the planet that doesn't know Jordan
Sorry.
Peterson. He's a clinical psychiatrist. He's probably the most famous one in the world.
Is he a psychiatrist or psychologist?
Yeah, good question. I'll have to just...
Check
that.
Okay.
I think, yeah.
He might be a psychologist.
He might be. I'll have to check. So sometimes my mouth runs before my thoughts. Also, I need to correct myself. You're absolutely right. It was Will Young's podcast. It's Dr. Romani who had the 8 million YouTube hit. That's just come to me. So I like to correct myself when I'm wrong. Is Kanye West mentally ill?
I think he probably has some traits that make his life very difficult.
Like?
He seems to have a lot of the traits of narcissistic PD.
Yeah. Yeah, I think it's sad what's happening with him. I don't think it looks from the outside in like he's not got enough people who really care about him putting their arm around him. And two more questions, 15 to 30 seconds. Best advice you ever received about good mental health?
Best advice I ever received about good mental health. Now, I know this sounds really, really simple, but it works. break everything down into smaller chunks. So we often say, take each day as it comes. I would say if you're in a really bad place, take each hour as it comes.
And what's the worst piece of advice you've ever been given or heard about mental health?
That there's no such thing as mental health problems.
Actually, I will add one in. Where's the line between mental health and mental illness?
Like I said earlier, it's when your regular day-to-day emotions are of an intensity, frequency and duration which is now interfering with your ability to affect change in reality. Okay, that's
could that be self-caused, self-perpetuated?
Yeah, but it's multifactorial. So like I said, there's the biological element, the psychological, social, financial, upbringing, genetics, drugs and alcohol, stuff you put in your body, there's your own nature. So yeah, all of those things. But honestly, for good mental health, I think if you can develop that side of yourself that is separate from what the world thinks you are and identifies you, that is probably one of the most powerful ways to develop and stay mentally healthy.
Mm. Have men been emasculated in today's society?
Ooh, that's a good question. You know what I find interesting? I think in this strive for equality between men and women, I think women have lost out in one sense, because a lot of the feminism has, or the feminist movement, I mean, I appreciate it. I know a lot of people have put, a lot of women have put a lot of effort into getting equal rights. But in that, there's been a disservice done in that trying to get to be considered of equal value, women have almost killed off their femininity in one sense. And you end up expecting to be, you know, behave and have the results and functions of both male and female and still not yet get equal value. So as a backlash to that, I've seen almost the denial of the masculine. Okay, either women start denying the masculine or men start denying the masculine in themselves. And that's not healthy either. So on the one hand, we don't want a planet which is denied the femininity and nurturing that comes, that's held by women and men. Because remember, masculine and feminine energy, whether you look at it psychologically in the brain or you look at it in terms of energies, both men and women hold 50% each of the masculine and the feminine. So women will hold 50% of the masculine energy on this planet. Men hold 50% of the feminine energy on this planet. So yes, I think we are in danger. I don't think it's happened yet, but I think we are in danger of doing something like saying, okay, men, curb your masculinity, and women also shut down your masculinity, because we need an increase of femininity on this planet. We don't have to push down one. It's not a seesaw. Okay, it's not a seesaw. You don't have to push down something just to raise the other side up. That's what a narcissist does. Okay? Mm. You can allow the feminine in both men and women to flourish without reducing the masculine.
Mm. You know, I was talking to a doctor. It was Dr. Robert Malone. And his advice on essentially evolving humanity was not something I'd heard before, and it's really coming out in our conversation here. And essentially it was, we're far less intelligent than we think we are, and nature is far more intelligent than we are, and we should be intervening less and thinking that we can change everything so much, make everything so much better. I mean, I'm adding to what he said.
Sure.
Basically, let nature do its thing. And that really hit me, actually. You know, if you think of so many industries, like maybe the pharmaceutical industry, and like the whole gender debate that's going on at the moment. Humans think we're so smart and intervening and can control and improve everything, when maybe we just get out of nature's way and let nature do its thing. What do you think about that?
Yeah, I agree with you. You know, nature's not plagued by envy, greed, you know,
no.
And anger.
No.
Even animals, when you see animals developing psychological problems because you now have, you know, pet psychiatrists, it's usually because some human beings have inflicted something on them which is not natural to their environment. So yeah, I agree, but if human beings get back to their nature rather than being so absorbed by man-made things, you know, it's a fact. You go out, spend some time in nature, there is an inner wisdom that does come out. You have a clearer thoughts, so you're not pulled in so many directions. We are more in harmony with nature. So that natural intelligence we have, where we do behave and speak in a way which keeps everything in harmony, it comes out. We're not, by nature, we don't want to have imbalance and lack of value and discrimination. By nature, that whole idea of offering love and receiving love, it's what we all crave. Doesn't put aside all the disorders. That's what's at the essence of all of us. So I think we should listen to nature more.
So final question. This show is called Disruptors. What does that word mean to you?
I think where there's got to be change, even positive change, some things need to be disrupted. And I think our world is being disrupted now in a big way so that the best things can emerge.
Perfect way to finish.
Thank you very much
for coming on the show.
Thank you so much, Rob.